He was not much older than Rahi. He was as broken as she was, she knew.
I'll make up the couch. You can sleep there.
An Indian boy would have given her the bed. She didn't care. She would sleep on the floor if she needed to. Thank you. She turned back to the room of things.
Did you call them? Your friends?
She started. What friends? Oh, I did not. She had not even thought of Rebecca and Satya. Now she felt ashamed. They would be worried for her, terrified. May I use your phone? He nodded. It rang and rang, and then a breathless Satya picked up.
Madam, is that you?
Hello. Yes, it is me. I am sorry. All is all right.
Where are you, madam? I am coming just now.
I am at the man's house from this morning. I am there only.
I am coming just now.
No, I will stay here. Thank you. I am sorry for your worries, for giving you fear, but I am all right now. You may come in the morning only, or not at all.
But madam, he is a pervert. And the door.
My tour is done. Thank you, Satya. Thank Rebecca. God bless you both. She thanked Jake and turned back to the room. Like an explorer on the edge of the jungle, she stepped in, desperate to see what she could find.
She never made it to the couch.
She fell asleep hours later, clutching a paper on saltwater plants that she had been struggling to read, and now let rest against her face as she lay on the floor of the room surrounded by the artifacts of her son's life and felt at home for the first time in years. She felt like she was floating in the ocean, and it was warm and soft, and it accepted her, and she was not alone.
Chapter 29.
To boss at AmericaBestNumberOneTours.com. From SatyaRoy57 at Yahoo.com.
Boss, please ignore text of yesterday. Madam enjoying tour very much so. Recommend to all friends. Happy in California very much. Exactly what she wanted. Satya. Sitting in the hotel lobby surrounded by a mountain of luggage, Satya wondered what had become of his tour, hoping Ronnie wouldn't see his frantic email from the day before when he was sure he had lost the widow. The trip had been going so well until they reached California and she went insane. Or maybe she had been insane the whole time, and had only just revealed it, which was a bit unfair, Satya thought. If you are going to be insane, you might as well just be insane from the beginning and not mess about with deception. Now he was stuck with all her belongings, and the only thing keeping him from panicking was a strange phone call from the perverted man, who assured him the widow was alive and well. He was not an experienced tour guide, he knew, but he did believe that keeping track of his clients was probably an important part of the job. He was supposed to be the person in charge here. But that was life. People had lives beyond what he could understand. There were more things that could happen and more ways that people could be. He would have to let his idea of things go, he thought, thinking of Ravi, and simply let things happen. There did not seem to be another option. He guarded the bags and waited for Rebecca. The trip was officially ending tomorrow, but he didn't know if Mrs. Sengupta would do any of her activities for the day, which included a tour of the Hollywood Hills and shopping on Rodeo Drive. Over an Indian dinner during which she had shouted at him about why gay people weren't perverts, and he had wished she would get drunk so he could kiss her again, he and Rebecca had decided that they would leave early if Mrs. Sengupta wasn't interested in the tour. Or rather, that he would leave early. Rebecca wanted to stay and contact some people in the industry, as she called it, though he failed to see what was so industrious about acting, a statement that started her yelling at him again. He thought about the feeling of her breasts when he had leaned against them trying to clutch one in his hand. He could barely remember, but he thought it had been nice.
What are you smiling about like an idiot?
Her voice was sharp, brittle now as she walked up to him.
She was nervous about Mrs. Sengupta as well, he knew,
Just like that, he said in response.
Rebecca cocked her head to the side in confusion and seemed to be about to question him, so we cut her off.
The man called today. She is still there with him. Will he try to molest her, do you think?
No!
Rebecca elongated the word so that two letters seemed like 20. Her eyes were off again, rolling away.
But he is a disgusting person. So are you. Stop looking at my chest.
What do we do now? Rebecca asked him.
I don't know.
Rebecca sat down next to him. He could feel her warmth through his shirt.
Is this normal? She asked.
I don't know.
Is this your first tour?
Rebecca asked it in a voice that made it clear she knew what the answer was. He nodded slowly. She sighed.
Should we go pick her up?
But what to do with all the bags?
She looked at their assorted luggage.
We'll have to bring them to her.
In the back of the cab, they looked at each other over the mountain of things, overstuffed bags and carefully wrapped glass. He didn't remember bringing this much with them. It was amazing, he thought, the things that people picked up along the way. They arrived back at the house, and Rebecca paid the driver. He let her. He had no money and no reason to be proud. They unpacked the bags and carted them like pack mules up onto the man's lawn.
What should I do? If she won't come? Satya asked.
I don't know.
Well, he supposed perhaps it was her turn to say it. They rang the bell and waited. Of all the traveling they had been doing, all the places they had been to, and all the driving they had done around the country, this seemed like the most arduous part of the journey, and the most overwhelming. It was a strange feeling to be manipulated by his client, to find that she had been guiding him instead of the other way around. The door opened, and he saw Jake's newly familiar face. He forced himself to make eye contact for longer than he wanted to. The man smiled at him.
Much better. You can hardly tell at all, he said, much to Satya's confusion.
Inside the house, the widow was sitting on the couch as she had been the day before, only this time she was bent over a notebook looking at something. As they moved into the house, Satya caught a glimpse of what it was. All drawings of snails. Each of their shells curled into itself endlessly, a swirling universe fitting into 2 inches of space.
How are you?
He asked Mrs. Sengupta. He hadn't meant to ask it in Bengali, but it slipped out of his mouth. It was amazing how they had spoken in English all this time, he thought. Was it because his Bengali wasn't good enough for her? Or because they were both being polite to Rebecca? Or maybe because in some way English seemed more appropriate and neutral than their mutual native tongue. But now he spoke to her with the care and comfort of his own language.
Thank you for coming, she responded in Bengali. I am well. I am sorry to have caused you distress.
She switched to English for the last part for Rebecca's benefit. Rebecca shrugged.
As long as you're all right.
Madam, about the door.
Mrs. Sengupta smiled weakly.
I think I am done with touring.
Of course, madam. Understood, understood. It is only...
Is there a way to change the ticket? Only Jake is going to take me to San Francisco.
The man looked startled.
I am,
said Jake.
I would like that, said Mrs. Sengupta placidly.
Jake exhaled a long breath.
I don't like you,
he said flatly to Mrs. Sengupta. Satya bristled, ready to defend his charge. She was still his client for another day.
I understand this. You can change this ticket? To leave from there in 5 days?
I will ask.
It's possible, Rebecca broke in. But you'll have to pay for it. Everything requires this only.
We've brought your bags, Rebecca said. Mrs. Sengupta nodded.
Thank you. You are very kind to me. Is tipping required?
Satya started coughing. The widow seemed to have abandoned tact. It's not required, but it's appreciated. At least for the medical bills for the heart attack you gave Satya.
Rebecca spoke in a deadpan, realizing too late that mentioning a heart attack was inappropriate. Mrs. Sengupta nodded again and reached into her purse. She handed them each a handful of crisp $100 bills.
Is this enough?
Only you can know that, Mrs. Sengupta.
It is more than generous, madam. Thank you, madam.
Satya tried to touch her feet for the last time, but she stood instead and reached out her hand for him to shake it. He fit his palm onto hers. It was the only time they had touched hand to hand, like equals. He looked at his dark hand in her much paler grip. Soon it was over and his palms felt sweaty. Mrs. Sengupta reached toward Rebecca to do the same thing, but Rebecca hugged her instead. Mrs. Sengupta looked confused and then, for a fleeting moment, sank into the embrace, letting herself be held. Rebecca leaned back and straightened.
It was nice to meet you, Pival, and good luck.
You have both been good to me. I came here under false reasons, and I did not tell you of this.
I am sorry. I thought if I did not find Rahi, I would die here. I am glad that I have met you, and that I am not dead.
Satya did not know what to say, and so he said goodbye. He would never see her again, he thought. He thought about all the people he would never see again. His grandmother, his mother, Ravi.
People he had known for much longer than Mrs. Sengupta.
And yet she had affected his entire life. He wondered what her life would look like from now on.
He wondered if everyone he had ever known would leave him too.
He wondered if he would get better at it as time went on, or if it would always feel as it did now, that a part of him was forever lost every time someone who knew him disappeared.
They took their bags and they left the house, and they said nothing as they hailed a cab and set off for the airport. Satya had changed his ticket and would be heading off that day, and Rebecca had offered to go with him, ostensibly to keep him company, but really to pay for the taxi. She suspected he would have tried to walk if she hadn't ordered the cab. Satya would go home to New York that very day. Rebecca would stay behind with a friend. The widow would do whatever it was she planned on doing, and they would never see each other again. Satya looked out the window as Los Angeles receded from view. Not that he had seen much of it in the first place. He wasn't sure if he could do this again, be a tour guide. Perhaps he wasn't suited for so many hellos and goodbyes, so many places passing in front of his eyes.
What do you think she meant?
Rebecca asked him this before he left. I think she was unhappy. Maybe she's happier now that she has met someone who knew her son.
Even though he's a pervert?
Satya shrugged. Disgusting people can be all right as long as they aren't perverting themselves on you. And maybe he will change. Meet a nice girl, become normal. She can help him.
Maybe. Will you stay in New York? Will you keep being a tour guide?
I don't know where else I would go, or what else I would do.
Rebecca thought for a moment. She reached into her bag and grabbed a piece of paper and a pen and wrote something down.
Here, call this number when you get back. I know someone who might help you.
He smiled at her.
Thank you.
Thank you. This has been a very interesting tour of America.
Satya snorted.
It really has, I promise.
Thank you. And she hugged him. He tried to absorb every feeling of her. As she pulled back, he kissed her again, hard, sticking his tongue down her mouth as much as it would go. She bit it. Satya reared back, cursing. She looked at him, calm, her face hard.
Don't say you're sorry. You're not.
He shook his head. He wasn't. They had reached the airport. Rebecca was going to take the cab back to Los Angeles. Satya apologized for having her go out of her way, picked up his small battered bag from the back of the cab and waved goodbye. She waved at him once and then put on her sunglasses. The taxi pulled away. Satya felt empty. He wished it had been different,
that she had sunk into him the way he had seen in movies and let him do all the things he wanted to do. He walked into the airport alone, and 10 hours later he was on a flight back to New York, watching the sun set on California as his plane sped east. From the plane, he took a train and a bus to get home. In his exhaustion, he almost went back to the place he had shared with Ravi and so many others, but he didn't. He went to his new home and fell into bed, face down, sleeping before his cheek even hit the pillow. 2 days later, he walked into Mr. Ghazi's shop and introduced himself. The man knew who Satya was because Rebecca had already called and prepared him, and when Satya walked out later, it was with a job. He would have told Ronnie in person, but Ronnie was on vacation with his wife, the first he had ever taken with her, and wasn't to be disturbed. So Satya left his resignation in a note on the desk. Satya got an additional job at a bookstore on Union Square, hauling boxes, nothing that required much of his mind. They did give him books at a discount, however, and he was thinking about buying a few of them. Between the map shop and working as a stock boy, he had just enough to pay for his life as long as he lived cheaply. That was fine for him. He knew no other way. His grandmother would have been proud of him. He lived now in a world of paper. He had received a letter from Ravi's mother while he was gone. She had thanked him for writing and told him that she was proud of them both. He had read it over and over again, absorbing the scent and the feeling of home through the words, thinking about where she was when she had written it, what she had been thinking, what of his old life was around her that she had pressed into the page. Then he put it back in the envelope. He passed the cart in the street on his way to work one day, the one run by the man who, he thought, knew Ravi. The man flinched as Satya passed and looked at him. But this time, Satya didn't yell at him. Instead, he passed him the letters. Included in them was a note, a recommendation for all the things Ravi would need to know to work with Ronnie, all the things he needed to become a guide. He hoped someday he would see Ravi again, but even if he didn't, he had given all he could. A week later, Ronnie told him that a new man had joined the company. Satya didn't ask who he was. He didn't have to. Ronnie told him that the new guide was doing well, training with the other guides, doing New York tours. Maybe someday he would take a group on a tour of the Southwest, Satya thought, and see the Grand Canyon. Satya smiled. One way or another, they would see it together. He went to work and studied maps of the world and thought about where he was in it. And when he was sick of that, he dusted and brought Mr. Ghazi his tea. Chapter 30.
I don't understand why you would build a city in a place that has such hills. It is too much up and down and walking everything. They should have made the city in a flat place, shouldn't they?
Mrs. Sengupta's face was screwed up with annoyance as she surveyed San Francisco. She looked at Jake, as if challenging him to explain it for her. She had done that often since they had met, looked at him, silently demanding that he give her reasons for the things she didn't understand.
"Were you this aggressive with your tour guide?"
Jake asked idly, swirling his coffee around in his cup. They sat at a tea shop in the Castro, where Mrs. Sengupta bathed her face in the steam of an expertly crafted Indian masala tea, while Jake had scandalized the establishment by ordering a latte.
I didn't bother asking him questions. It was clear he knew nothing. And when Rebecca had something to say, she just said it. Such an amazing thing to be able to do that. To have the confidence. I have never felt such a thing.
Jake looked away. Mrs. Sengupta, or Pival, as she had asked him to call her, had grown both bolder and more contemplative the more time they spent together. He still wasn't sure how exactly he had ended up traveling with her to San Francisco, taking a week off work and spending his time escorting his dead boyfriend's sari-clad mother around the city, but here he was. Somehow she had gotten him there, with her calm statements and her desperate need. Part of him was happy to do it, really. Part of him had, he knew, wanted to throw it in her face. The freedom Beam had had in America, the way his life and self had been acceptable here. Why else would Jake have booked them an apartment in the heart of San Francisco's historical gay district? Why did he insist on taking her to gay bars, crashing a gay wedding in the Shakespeare Garden in Golden Gate Park, pointing out every same-sex couple that passed them on the street? But if he had meant to shame Pivol, his actions were having the opposite effect. Instead, with every couple they saw, Pivol seemed to relax a fraction of an inch. Beam must have been happy here. Pivol was looking at the window as she spoke, a soft smile playing on her lips. You can be whatever you want here. He had never had such freedom in his life. He must have been drunk off it. Jake smiled at her description.
I suppose. He often seemed quite reserved to me. I don't think I would have liked to meet him in India. I can't imagine him even stiffer.
Jake realized as he said it, this was true. You don't have to. You had him at his best. Pivol spoke without bitterness, mournful but without rancor, and Jake wondered how he had gone from hating someone to caring for her so quickly. For the last few days since she'd asked to stay with him, Jake had felt a rising tide of panic, fear that as he lost his resentment, there would be nothing left to keep him going. But somehow he woke up every morning, breathing, thinking, worrying about his new cat, wondering if she liked her exorbitantly expensive sitter. Somehow, even without the engine of anger he'd depended on for the past year, he was still living. Living better, even. I could not have imagined a place like this where someone could feel so good about who they are and what they want.
You should have visited him.
Jake wondered why they hadn't, at least before Beam came out. They had the money, he knew, and he assumed they didn't have the time or inclination.
Yes, I should have. My husband didn't like long trips, you see, and I did not know then how to travel.
But now you do.
Pivol smiled at him. I am learning. Every day it is only about doing it, and suddenly it is happening. I am learning, slowly, slowly. It is worth it. I thought I was too old to learn, but here I am doing it again. And I am happy that I am.
So am I, Jake thought.
Will you take me to where he worked?
Of course.
Is it by the ocean?
You know, that is a funny thing about Rahi. As much as he loved water, he never learned to swim.
Jake smiled.
Funny you should mention that. They took the train to Berkeley,
Pivol exclaiming the whole time at how clean it was. That was her first comment most places she went. How very clean.
Is India so very dirty then?
Jake asked.
He had not asked Beam much about India, not after it became clear this was another dangerous subject, and never after Beam had come out to his parents.
Pivol smiled wryly. She had a dry sense of humor that Jake liked. Everywhere in her he was looking for parts of Beam, but they never were where he thought they would be. Instead, he found them on the edges of things, in a mispronunciation they shared, the number of spoonfuls of sugar and tea, the way they licked their fingers and smoothed their eyebrows elegantly and disgustingly at once.
India is often dirty, yes. But parts of it are not. You should come see for yourself.
You aren't making a strong case for it,
Jake teased her. She took him seriously, though.
No, you should. You would understand Beam better, being there.
I understand him better here.
Together, between the two parts, it makes sense.
I'll have to visit, then, Jake said, not really meaning it.
Yes, you will. Pivol said, meaning every word.
Getting off the train at the Berkeley BART station, they walked the streets of the little suburban town, dry and verdant and teeming with students. They visited Beam's lab, and Pivol shook hands with each of the scientists who'd known and admired her son. They showed her his research, tried to explain its implications, showered her with a downpour of technical terms and excitement for Beam's brilliance. She touched the pages of his thesis, printed, bound, and carefully stored in the university library, with reference. It is amazing when the person you made makes something that you never could, she said. Jake, thinking of the way his own mother made sure to drive by as many of his projects in a day as possible, smiled. Pivol took the snail shell he had given her out of her purse, examining the whorls with her fingers and her eyes.
Did they know about him?
She asked Jake, suddenly anxious.
Beam never talked to anyone about his personal life much, Jake said. But when he passed away, many of them came to the funeral and met me. They knew who I was.
And they didn't mind?
She asked, her eyes wide.
Does it seem like they minded?
They looked around the lab. One of Beam's advisors, an algae specialist, was waving them over to look at something amazing that Beam had found. Jake put his hand on Pivol's shoulder, and they went to look into a microscope at tiny, vitally important things that they might never grasp and couldn't wait to see. Jake took her to Beam's favorite cafe, the Indian restaurant that would make him fish curries if he asked in Bengali, the grocery store where they had shopped for organic produce when Jake tried to teach Beam to cook. He took her to the apartment where Beam had lived, the soulless place where Jake and Beam had, together, achieved a little bit of joy. It was rented to someone else now, but they were kind and let them in for a brief visit. She looked around once and smiled. When they left, she turned back to Jake.
That was not a very nice place.
Jake laughed.
I was the one who cared about what things looked like. Beam said he never noticed.
That sounds like my Rahi. Completely oblivious to the world outside his own mind. And yet you spent more time in Los Angeles, you said.
We did, yes. His work was mobile and...
Then perhaps he did notice after all.
They stood out on the street watching bicyclists speed by, people walking their dogs, a couple, both men, holding hands. The couple walked unself-conscious down the street, lifting their joined hands over the head of a child on a bright pink plastic bicycle, forming an arch above her head for a moment, before she moved on and they let their arms fall, still holding hands, still walking along. Jake looked over at Pivol. She was crying. She reached over and wiped a tear off his own cheek.
This is a very nice place, isn't it?
And Jake nodded because it was true.
This was the best place for him, wasn't it? Better than being at home with me?
The best thing, I think, would have been not having to choose,
Jake said. And Pivol nodded and smiled through her tears.
I'm glad that he had you. I'm glad that he was loved by you.
There was nothing for Jake to say to that, so instead he hugged her until their faces dried in the California sun, and then they went back to the train, back to the city, back into the world. Jake had arranged for her flight to be changed so that she could return to Kolkata from San Francisco, not Los Angeles. They departed on the same day, her before him, and as he watched her be swallowed up by the airplane terminal, a small figure draped in fabric fading into the background. He knew, despite everything, despite however he had felt before, he would miss her. Together, they had fit the two pieces of Beam's life into one. He knew Beam better because of her, and when she thanked him in the end, he knew part of it was for what she now knew, for the memories he had traded with her. Now he was home in Los Angeles. It had hurt to take her to Berkeley, but it had felt good, like the ache after running or the way stretching makes your body feel better after it feels much worse. He had felt so much less alone mourning Beam with her. The cat was still alive in his house, and he named her Draupadi. Mrs. Sengupta had explained the origin of the name Beam, the story of him and his four brothers, brothers the real Beam had never had. And the princess who had married all five of them, the beautiful Draupadi. His cat was beautiful, and if Beam had lived, she would have been both of theirs. So the name seemed to fit. He was restless, and he worked long hours, and he ran long distances. But Beam's ashes still sat on the shelf, and he watched them sometimes. He had wanted Mrs. Sengupta to take them, but she had refused. So there they were now, waiting for something. He didn't know for what. Chapter 31. Rebecca brushed her teeth, looked at herself in the mirror, and spat. Her face contorted wildly in the early morning light. She was staying with an old friend, an actress she had known in New York who had moved to Los Angeles and kept promising to move back and never did. Her friend, Shayna, had a neat and carefully curated apartment with large windows drinking in the California sunshine. Rebecca squinted, feeling like a vampire, annoyed by the rays. New York had made her bitter, she thought, rolling her eyes at her own cliché. Life in Los Angeles was appealing, she could certainly see that. She had been there for 3 days, since Mrs. Sengupta had sent them away, and Satya had left for New York. 3 days that she had filled with cold brewed coffee and yoga classes and meetings over drinks, endless drinks, that everyone sipped lightly, barely tasting before ordering another. Drinks were not objects, they were networking tools. But some part of Rebecca still regretted the waste, no matter how much she told herself it was an investment in her future. She met with agents and managers and smiled and chatted and gave a resume and felt them assessing her. Her body, her voice, her smile. She knew if they could, they would have cupped her body, man and woman alike, testing that too, like a melon at the market. She was exhausted, more than she had been in her travels running from place to place. She kept looking up from conversations and from networking over cocktails and coffees and thinking, what am I doing here? What does any of this have to do with acting, with being on stage? Shayna had a lovely life, Rebecca had to admit, if a bit brittle. By all rights, she was doing wonderfully. She was working, a few small parts on television shows, commercial work every month or so with large enough brands to keep her more than comfortable between jobs. She looked fit, and her skin was clear and swelling with moisture, but her eyes were strained and almost hunted. There was something close to breaking around her edges. Something mirrored in every friend of Shayna's Rebecca met, who was in the industry. If in New York actors were high-strung and cutting, in Los Angeles they all showed a little wear and tear under the pressure of being so visibly relaxed all the time. It was as if they were boiling under the strain of being so chill. Everything was fine, everything was great, everything was so light it could crush you. People drank happiness with their kombucha, but it didn't seem to sit right in their stomachs, from the fear you could see in their faces when they thought no one was looking. Rebecca told herself this was all in her head. She was being deliberately negative. She left the bathroom and dressed for the day, donning spandex for a hike in the mountains. The air that filled her lungs was clear, and the sun seemed healing, not stinging as it had in the morning hours before. She watched Shayna try to take the perfect selfie, pouting her lips, sucking in her cheeks, jutting out her collarbones. It's good marketing, really. I'm up for a part as a trainer in a new movie, someone the main character thinks about cheating on his wife with. The casting director follows me on Instagram. Rebecca nodded as Shayna spoke, overwhelmed. Should she be doing this? It was so much work, this place that prided itself on being so effortless. That night they went to a party. Something in the hills with lots of important people. Rebecca wore a tight red dress and danced and drank vodka and smiled at everyone. And people told her she was gorgeous and charming and laughed at her quick East Coast wit. And suddenly this trip she had been on seemed very far away. She had been wrong. It wasn't brittle here at all. It was bright and perfect. And she should move here forever and be in movies and be happy. Everyone else was, weren't they? But as she lay in bed at night, even the alcohol couldn't help her sleep. And she thought about Mrs. Sengupta. She thought about Satya, and she hoped he would call the number she had given him. Hoped he would work for Mr. Ghazi. She knew that she wouldn't anymore. She wasn't sure what she was going to do, but Sethia needed that job. He needed the Ghazis more than she did. She turned over on Shayna's couch, trying to get comfortable. She checked her phone. It was 7 a.m. on the East Coast. She didn't know many people who would be awake, but she knew someone. She slipped out of the apartment and dialed.
Rebecca?
Her mother's voice, despite everything, made her smile. Cynthia had been waking up at 6 to run every weekday morning since Rebecca was a child. She knew she would be walking home now, stretching out her body slowly. She could see her on the streets of Washington, sweaty and triumphant.
"You're up early," Cynthia said, tentative.
She clearly hadn't forgotten their dinner any more than Rebecca had.
"I'm up late. I'm in Los Angeles."
"Has the trip ended?"
"Yes, I'm here for a few days before heading back east."
"Ah, and how is it?"
Rebecca looked around at the empty streets. The flowers blooming, the green all around her. The orderly neatness of Los Angeles, so unlike New York's squalor.
"It all looks great, but..."
"It doesn't feel that way."
"It's making me tired. Just in a completely different way."
"Of course. It's exhausting, all that healthy living."
Rebecca laughed. She could see her mother's face, visualizing her own expression in it.
"It is! How do they do it?"
"Heavy medication," Cynthia quipped dryly.
"I had hoped it might be better here for me," Rebecca confessed.
She closed her eyes, the night air cool on her face. "New York has been hard." She held her breath. Would her mother laugh? Scold her, reminding her of how she had told her so? The dinner at her parents' loomed large in her mind.
"I'm sorry, sweetie."
Rebecca felt on the verge of tears. When was the last time her mother had said that to her? And really meant it.
"I want you to be happy. It's hard for me, knowing that you're not. Do you think I will be happy in Los Angeles?"
"I think they kick you out if you're not."
"It's such a strange place, Mom. Everything seems so thin."
"That's because you're spending time with actors. They don't eat."
"No, I mean, nothing feels real."
"I know. Do you know your father and I thought about moving there a long time ago?"
"You did?"
"Yes, but we didn't. We took a trip, and as we left, your father said to me, 'Oh, thank God we can stop being happy all the time.'"
Rebecca laughed and laughed, tears rolling down her cheeks. It wasn't all that funny, she knew, but she found it hilarious. And now she was crying.
"Oh, Rebecca, don't cry."
"This isn't digging ditches or breaking rocks, I know that. But it's still hard, Mom."
"I know it is. I wish you did something else, not because I think you can't do this, but because thinking about all the people who say no to you, it makes me so mad, honey. So mad for you."
"Thanks, Mom."
"That's why you have to say yes when you can. I'm happy you went on this trip, love. I'm happy you said yes to something."
As Rebecca hung up, ending the best conversation she'd had with her mother in years, she realized she was too. After a week, she went home to New York. Her check was waiting for her in the mailbox. There was not a word said about losing and regaining their widow, nor a word from the widow herself. She had thought it would be wonderful to be back in New York, but it felt strange. She had survived outside of it, and now it did not feel as essential to her as it had before she had left. Nothing was essential, it turned out. She sat in her apartment and thought about what to do next. Her agent called her with an audition for a job out of town, and for the first time ever, she said yes. After the audition, which had gone wonderfully, even she could admit, she took the subway to a Bengali restaurant in Queens. All that time on the road, and she had never had Bengali food. She looked at her phone. She'd gotten the job. It would be in a theater in Chicago. She ordered fish baked in mustard paste. She thought about calling her parents, Mr. Ghazi,
the guy she'd met last night, and telling them she was leaving New York for a bit. She looked at her phone and decided it could wait. She took out a piece of paper. She thought about the widow and the way her son had written her those letters. "Dear Mrs. Sengupta," she began. In Chicago, everything was built at a massive scale, Rebecca realized. Perhaps there was just so much more space out there in the flatlands. The theater company had put her up in a beautiful apartment, 4 times the size of her studio in New York, and when they had apologized profusely for the tiny size, she had struggled not to giggle. On her first day of rehearsals, unable to sleep, she looked out through her window at sunrise, watching the massive, sleepy city wake slowly, sweetly. Today she was going to go to a theater and become someone else for a while. And without even trying, she was happy. Chapter 32. When Pival returned to Kolkata, the first thing she did was fire all the servants. Well, the second thing, because the first thing had been to drink a good cup of tea while listening to Tanvi scold and wail at her. She was surprised, frankly, that anyone was still there. She had assumed that they would bunk, as her son used to say, that is, cut out, leave, be gone from the apartment. She had expected all her belongings to be gone with them, had even anticipated with some sense of relief an empty apartment robbed of all its wealth. But then she remembered, her return wasn't so unexpected to them, only to herself. And of course, they would fear being charged with theft, no matter how much she had urged them to take things. A few saris, a bangle, would be the most they would dare. On the drive from the airport, looking out on the city she had thought she would never see again, she assessed Kolkata with open eyes. The ugliness and the rare beauties, cement housing and fading wooden doors. Letting herself into her flat, she interrupted lunchtime, and suddenly both the maids, the cook, and the driver were fluttering around her, crying and touching her feet, treating her like a returned hero, the Pandavas coming back from the forest. She was forced into a chair and served tea and biscuits before she could get a word in, and then the haranguing began. "How could you leave, madam? We were so worried. You must never do this again." On and on it went, a stream of reproaches and guilt-inducing statements that would have made her shrivel up into a ball a month ago, promising anything just to make it stop. Now she straightened, put her tea aside, thanked Tanvi politely, and told her she was fired. She offered her and each of the other servants a severance that was more than any of them typically made in a year, and thanked them for everything they had ever done for her, for Ram, and for Rahi. Most of them nodded, resigned, but Tanvi almost seemed relieved. She wailed and screamed, it was true, but behind it there was the sense of a burden laid to rest. Maybe that was just the weight that had rested on her heart so long. Pival didn't know. They moved out the next week, taking money back to their villages or going on to other posts. Pival wrote Tanvi a recommendation that stressed her care and downplayed her judgmental nature and saw her on her way. Sitting alone in the apartment she had never thought she'd see again, she felt a sense of peace. She packed away Ram's photograph, the fading marigolds around it, the incense and the offerings. She didn't have to pray to him anymore. All the ghosts of her old life were gone now, except Rahi's, and even that one was a ghost of love. To find new servants, Pival enlisted the help of an organization that rehabilitated women from Kolkata's red light district and trained them for housework. They were often immigrants, Pival was told. Girls from Nepal, Tibet, and Bangladesh, of course, who had been displaced or come to India for a better life, or been sold as children and spent their lives in brothels, or waiting on sidewalks for men to buy their bodies. They often had trouble finding homes for their girls, Pival learned from the head of the organization, a woman with graying hair and a crisp cotton sari and such life in her eyes. People didn't trust these women to be good workers, not to tempt their husbands, not to seduce their sons. They saw them as vamps, willing women, not humans looking for a new life.
Pivil hired two girls that day, a quiet Bangladeshi woman who almost never talked and who swept the floors, and a cook from Tibet who made wonderful vegetable dishes and never ever cared what Pivil did with her time. She spent her days reading all the poetry she had wanted to explore, the Tagore book she had brought with her on her trip that she hadn't opened once, and books about sea snails. She saw movies on her own and ate new foods, and bought bottles of wine just to have in her home. She responded to requests from Ram's family, all asking her to come live with them, stay with them, visit them, with clear but firm negative responses, and they soon stopped asking, which was just fine with her. She visited cemeteries and took long walks around the city, first through walking tours, then on her own. She was finally getting to know her own city, after seeing so many foreign ones. She began to teach her maid and her cook English, starting slow, letting them absorb it, watching the fear in their eyes become happiness a little more each day. It was an almost perfect life, and she couldn't believe she had been ready not to have one anymore. Except that she still wasn't sleeping well, so she kept waiting for something to happen. And then one day, the doorbell rang, and there was Jake, standing in the doorway, her son's ashes in his hands, his face open, tense, worried, hopeful. She opened up the door and let him in. Jake sat on her couch in her living room and drank the milky tea served by the new maid. Pivil had introduced him as a friend of her son's, and then thought again. She turned to the maid.
"Actually, he was my son's lover," she said, watching the woman carefully.
The maid simply nodded and left. This was the first person she had ever said that to, the first person she admitted the truth to, and it felt beautiful, the way truth is supposed to be.
"Will you be staying long?"
she said to Jake.
"I think that's up to you,"
he responded. They took the ashes to the Ganges the next day. They held the box together and let the ashes and the little shell fall into the sacred waters, watching Rahi slip away. He held her hand afterward as the tears from her eyes slipped into the Ganges as well, and she didn't mind at all, even if they were in public and people were watching them. What must they think, watching this old Indian woman with this strange white man holding each other's hands and crying? Ram would have hated it. A flare of happiness spread through her whole body, a warmth that emanated out from the hand that held hers. As she watched the water take him away, as it had taken so many people away and would take her too someday, she wondered, where would she go next? What would Rahi have wanted to see? She rinsed her hands in the water and stood up. And that night, with Jake in the next room, she slept deeply and fully, and she didn't dream of anything at all. The ghosts were gone now, and when she woke, the first thought she had was, what happens next? And she got up to go and find out.
This is Sunila Nankani. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of America for Beginners, a novel by Leah Frankie. This program was produced by Dion Audio. Executive producer, Katie Ostroka. Text copyright 2018 by Leah Frankie. Production copyright 2018 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.